everybody. Welcome to Growing Up Indigo with me, Akina, and you're on the BBS radio station, and we are the number one station for internet radio. Today, I have with us Edie Weinstein. She's an MSW, an LSW, and she's so much more. I was really looking forward to this. She's very colorful. She's a creative journalist. She's an inspiring transformational speaker, a licensed social worker, an interfaith minister, editor, radio host herself, a bliss coach, an event producer, a cosmic concierge, and she's the author of The Bliss Mistress Guide to Transforming the Ordinary into the Extraordinary, and she's the co-author of Embraced by the Divine, The Emerging Woman's Gateway to Power, Passion, and Purpose. Welcome, Edie. Hi.
Hi, thank you. I'm glad to be on the show. That, I always say whenever I hear my bio, that woman is really busy. When does she sleep?
Yeah, and then I was looking at, you know, your whole, you know, everything you've done and the people you've interviewed, and I'm like, oh, my God. You know, you've interviewed Shirley MacLaine, the Dalai Lama. I was like, Marianne Williamson. I'm like, I have to know, like, what it was like and when you were, why were you interviewing them?
Well, back in 1988, my husband and I created a magazine called Visions. We were based in the Philadelphia area, and for 10 years, from 88 to 98, we published a magazine that focused on holistic health, wellness, spirituality, environmental concerns, and peace and social justice issues.
Wow.
And all of those were our cover people. We wanted to be able to present to our readers kind of a behind-the-scenes look at the people whose books they've read, whose workshops they attended, whose music they listened to. I wanted to make it real. When I interview people, probably just like you, it's not your typical Q&A. It's more of a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So in the 10 years we had the magazine, I interviewed a bulk of the people you mentioned, and then the Dalai Lama interview took place in 2008, long after the magazine. Michael and I published it for the 10 years, those interceding 10 years, and then we sold it 6 months before he died in 1998, and then I became a freelance journalist, and I interviewed many more people since then.
That's
and
amazing.
What it was like was, you know, imagine being able to have conversations with people who inspire you. That's
I
what
am.
It felt like.
Mm-hmm. I know. How do you do that? You call the Dalai Lama and say, hi. I'm Edie. I'd
no.
like to interview you.
that one took 20 years to manifest.
Right.
The other interviews, when we had the magazine, and since I've been a freelancer, people have either reached out to me and said, we want you to interview us, their publishers, their media people, or they have directly, or I've reached out to them. The Dalai Lama interview was a different critter. That one took place, as I said, over a 20-year period where I seed planted in my head. I said, I want to do this. I would love to interview His Holiness. And there's nobody in my life that said, oh, no, that's never going to happen. Everybody I told said, oh, yeah, absolutely, we know it will someday. So I used a technique that I encourage your listeners to use whenever they want to create something in their lives. And the first is the thought. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind that everything that exists on this planet was once a thought in someone's mind. Whether it's a book or a table or a lamp, the phone that I'm talking to you on was once somebody's creative spark. And that spark was planted in me. So I reinforced it by creating vision boards with his picture on it. I put a picture of me next to a picture of him in close proximity. I wrote questions as if I'd be interviewing him the next day. I told people I was going to do it. In 2005, I think it was, he came to Rutgers Stadium in New Jersey, and I was asked to help promote the event. And I said, oh, I would love to, and by the way, is he granting interviews? No, he's not. And I said, all right, well, I'll do it anyway. So I went there, walked around the stadium with my tape recorder, and instead I interviewed the people that were there, and I asked them what it meant to them to be there and what he meant to them. So I don't even remember where the article got published. And when we all left, they gave us each a postcard with a picture of His Holiness on it. So I taped it to the dashboard of my car. And several cars later, it's still there. I still have it in my car. So his image was with me all the time. fast forward to probably spring of 2008, and a dear friend who's an American-born Buddhist is also very much involved with the Tibetan Rice Movement said, I'm going to bat for you here. I can't promise, but it looks like there's a possibility. You know, hold on to your hat. So he eventually became the event producer. So that increased my odds dramatically. In early July of 2008, I'm at a music festival, which I'm actually going to again tomorrow. It's from a Philadelphia radio station called WXPN. And I'm there at the Exponential Music Festival, standing with two friends. One of them is a photographer. The phone rings, and it's my friend Greg Schultz. And he says, "Are you sitting down?" And I said, "Should I be?" And he said, "Absolutely. Take off July 16th and 17th. You have the interview. And by the way, you're the only journalist in Philadelphia that he's granting an interview to." I screamed into the phone, as you might imagine. Mm-hmm. My photographer friend snapped the picture, and I still have the picture. And I went, wow, oh, my God. Then imposter syndrome kicked in. Do you know what that is?
No.
Are you familiar with that concept? Imagine, feeling like an imposter.
Oh,
no
yeah,
matter
totally.
How successful you are, mm-hmm. no matter how much people tell you that they like your
yes.
work, you
yes.
think, uh-oh, they're going to find out that I'm really not all that in a bag of chips.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, what if I mess up? What if I forget what I was going to say? What if I get laryngitis? I was somewhere between, can I say the S word?
No, I didn't hear it. I just heard the S.
Holy you know what.
Mm-hmm.
Holy you know what, and orgasmic bliss. And I said, when in doubt, go for the orgasmic bliss. So I just felt so over the moon excited about it. And then the imposter syndrome kicked in. And then I thought, okay, you would not have been given this opportunity if you hadn't
right.
earned your chops. So the next day, Greg calls me back, and he says, you still have the interview, but they want the Philadelphia Inquirer there, too, because I was doing this as a freelancer. And you don't think I said, nah, if I can't have it to myself, I don't want it.
No,
I said, absolutely. I'd be
right.
happy to share the glory. And it turns out that the other journalist, David O'Reilly, is somebody whose work I had read for years. He was the religion columnist for the Inquirer. So the day before, he and I are standing at a Buddhist temple in Philadelphia, and we're looking around at all of these other journalists and feeling like conspiratorial little kids, thinking they don't know that tomorrow at this time we're going to be with His Holiness. And he says, I got a new suit for the occasion. I said, I got a new dress for the occasion. So we were excited about that. And the next day we were ushered in to his hotel room at the Four Seasons in Philly, and it was the experience of a lifetime. As soon as I walked in and saw him, of course, I started crying. And he approached us. And when you meet His Holiness, you wear a white silk scarf. It's called a kata, K-A-T-A-H. And you fold it in a particular way, and you hold it out. You hold it in prayer pose, namaste pose.
Mm-hmm.
And then he takes it, blesses it, and puts it around your shoulders. Well, he hugged me. And you know that feeling, if you remember back to junior high school, and the person you have a crush on kisses you on the cheek, and you think, oh, my God, I'll never wash again. I'll never wash my face again. And when I tell the story, I say, you know, I've washed quite a few times since 2008. But it left a lasting impression. So for the next 45 minutes, we each asked him questions. And David's questions were more mainstream news kind of questions. And I thought, you know, I'm not going to miss this opportunity to, again, to do what I did with the other interviews, to get to know this man as a human being,
mm-hmm.
not as a political figure. So the interview is available if people want to read it. Actually, there's an article that I wrote for Elephant Journal about, I think it's something like how interviewing the Dalai Lama changed my life forever.
Mm-hmm.
And it includes the interview. So that's how that happened. A long-winded answer.
Well, you know, I wanted to ask you if that was the zenith. Of course, you've done so many other things. But in terms of interviews, when I was looking at the group of people that you had interviewed, of course, the Dalai Lama was probably the most inspiring. Or can
no,
I not say that?
Yes, well, absolutely. Everybody that I interviewed had their own gifts to offer. I mean, I interviewed
mm-hmm.
Ben and Jerry. They
I know,
were fun.
I thought-
The Dalai, you know, they didn't, we were disappointed that they didn't give us ice cream or even coupons for discount for ice cream. But it was fun. I mean, that was a fun interview. Mm-hmm. A lot of the entertainers I've interviewed were fun interviews. This was a spiritual,
right,
pivotal life event experience, surrealistic, like, oh my God, I can't believe this actually happened. I think this year was the 9th anniversary, 9th, yeah, it was 2008, so 9 years ago. I did it. Now, it also had another spiritual component to it that's kind of bittersweet. My dad had died that April, and he grew up in South Philadelphia. Now, if people have seen the Rocky movie, that's where the character of Rocky Balboa lived, in South Philly. So my dad knew everybody. I figured he worked some connections upstairs to help me get the interview. My mother my mother had been diagnosed with kidney disease and congestive heart failure around that time as well. And she had always believed that I was going to get the interview as well. And the day before the interview, he spoke at the Kimmel Center, which is this huge venue in Philadelphia, and it was his birthday. So this gigantic sheet cake was wheeled out onto the stage with one candle in the middle, and I guess it's not a Tibetan ritual to blow the birthday candles out, because he started cutting the cake without, you know, we sang happy birthday to him, and he started cutting the cake without blowing the candle out. And eventually he got the message. People said, blow the candle out. Mm-hmm. And everybody there got a piece. Now, I got the very last piece of the cake, and I took it out into a corner of the waiting room lobby, and I called my mother, and she was living in Florida at the time, and I said, guess what you and I are doing right now? We're having the Dalai Lama's birthday cake. And I think we probably both cried.
that was symbolic and fantastic.
Yeah. It was a proud mama moment, I'm sure. The Yiddish word is kvelling. I don't know if you know that word.
Of course I do.
Like to burst with pride. Yeah. So I got to share the Dalai Lama's birthday cake with my mom. And then two and a half years later, she died. So she got to have that experience with me.
That's beautiful. It really is.
Thank you.
I want to go back to what you started to say. You started, the way you did this was, you have the thought, you have the vision, but you did, you took steps toward doing it, and you didn't think about how. You didn't think about doing it yourself. You just knew you would. You took some steps, and you let the universe do it for you. When we spoke, what I loved about this was you were talking about, you know, you're a full-body makeover, and I knew it wasn't a makeover. You know, I knew that, but we came up with, well, first I have to ask you something else, but what I loved was, this is really all about having lived life and having to reinvent or step up to the plate and start over again, no matter what happens to you, and being a survivor. Yeah. And so we are going to talk about that, but I'm very interested in what you do at www.cuddleparty.com. You're a cuddlist professional.
So I'm glad to tell you about Cuddle Party.
Tell me what you do as a cuddlist professional.
Okay. Well, Cuddle Party is a 3.5-hour workshop that focuses on communication, boundary setting, safe, nurturing touch, non-sexual touch by consent. Now, that's a long-winded way of saying it's a relationship workshop and it's a touch workshop. In our culture, not just the American culture, but probably cultures all around the world, we are touch-starved. For most people, touch is either, you know, when they were growing up, either limited, non-existent, abusive, coercive, or sexual. And I was very lucky that I grew up in a family where it was none of those things. It was by consent. It was affectionate. I used to tell my mom that she raised me to be a cuddle party facilitator, because I grew up in a very touchy-feely family. We have skin hunger. It's just as important to meet as food hunger. So when someone is deprived of healthy touch needs, just like babies fail to thrive, adults fail to thrive too. High incidence of suicide, high incidence of depression, loneliness, eating disorders, addiction, all of those things, I can't say they can be cured by hugs and cuddles, but they sure can help, be helped by them. So in this workshop, adults, it's only for adults, 18 and over, come dressed in PJs or sweats or yoga clothes, because PJs are the great equalizer. When you're dressed like that, nobody knows what you do professionally, and people are so much less threatening when they're wearing PJs. So it's fun. We start the workshop out by doing what's called the welcome circle, and we go over the rules of cuddling, and there are rules because they make people feel safe.
Right.
Cuddle Party, I'm not the founder of it. Cuddle Party was created by Reed Mihalko and Marsha Baczynski. They're two relationship coaches. And when I met them and I went to my very first Cuddle Party, it was in New York when they lived there. Now they're both out in California. One of them, I think, Reed is in Oakland and Marsha's in San Francisco. And they created this workshop and then they trained certified facilitators. So it's not just people getting together and doing a puppy pile. It's a full-blown relationship workshop.
Mm-hmm.
So after the welcome circle, after some opening exercises, creating the safe container for this, there's 2.5 hours of freestyle cuddling, which is spooning, snuggling, massaging, all by verbal consent, which means if you went there with somebody you know or your partner or a friend, you would have to ask their permission to touch them and vice versa. Couples come to it. Individuals come. I have some people who are in committed relationships and one partner is not as affectionate physically as the other partner. And they say, go, have a good time. It's fun. And people attend multiple times. It's not just a one and done thing for a lot of folks. The other thing that's really cool about it is a lot of people have misperceptions of what it is. It's not an orgy. Nobody gets naked.
Of course.
It's non-sexual. I'm there and the other facilitators who do this, and I think there's like 140 of us now around the world. I was number 27.
Wow.
I was certified in 2006. And it started in 2004. And if you go to the website, you'll see the history of it. But a lot of people think, ooh, icky strangers. Who wants to cuddle with strangers? And I tell them that maybe in the beginning people feel like strangers, but by the end of it they feel like family of choice, creating community, ways of bringing people together across all kinds of lines. If you look around them, and I tell people this at the workshop, look around the room and you'll see people that you could just as easily see in the supermarket checkout line. You could see, at the library, wherever you go. They're normal people. They're people that may be hungry for touch and attention and affection, but it doesn't mean that they're losers. It doesn't mean that they're necessarily lonely. I have a lot of love in my life and a lot of affection, and I get a lot out of being there. As a facilitator, I'm right in there with everybody. And it's an opportunity for me, particularly as a workaholic codependent, to learn to hear people say no sometimes. And it's for me to be able to say no. I've had a hard time setting boundaries. And this workshop helps me to do that. So that's
what, saying no to people? Well, you just
say if somebody says, if somebody says, can I massage your feet and I don't feel like having my feet massaged, I would say no, thank you.
Right.
Or if I say, can I hug you, and they say no, I do my best not to feel offended by it, because here's a lesson, a real big lesson for me, is I used to only ask for what I thought people would say yes to. Have you ever done that?
Mostly, I don't ask.
You don't ask, okay. What stops you? What stops you?
I don't feel I have a right to ask anybody for anything. That's just, really, that's my problem. I'm here to fix it. I'm not here to ask you.
I'm the one that fixes it. I'm the caretaker.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the one that. Now, here's the thing about that I've learned. Those of us who give without being willing to receive, and I can't speak for you. I should only speak for myself. Is that I'm pretty darn arrogant. Because that means, you need me, but I don't need you.
No,
I can do this myself.
No, it's fear. It's really fear.
Yeah.
I fear that I'm going to be rejected anyway.
Right. But I'm saying that's for me is the arrogance. Like, okay, I'm the caregiver. I'm the one that does this. I don't need you. That's my snarky inner voice. But you're right. A lot of it is fear. Like, who am I to ask for support?
That's how I feel.
Somebody might say no. But you know how good it feels, right, to be loving and caring and giving to other people.
I love it.
And I... Yeah. So wouldn't it be great if you let the people who love you shower you with love? Wouldn't that be a good feeling for them?
No. I mean, yes, but I don't know.
Yeah, for them.
I shut down as soon as I go there. That's a real big problem for me. I just shut down.
Okay.
I can't believe they would. And so, and I have been proven that they won't in life during many, many very difficult situations. So that's why.
Okay, so are there people that you have asked for love and support and caring and they have followed through? Okay, so remind yourself of that. And the thing is, you don't ever have to ask, but practice it. And Cuddle Party gives people the opportunity to practice. And that's, it's a lab setting. It's a great experiment. And I do it too. I have a hard time asking too. And I've learned that if people say no, it's not the end of the world. It just means that somebody else is going to be the one to deliver what I'm asking for. And if I don't receive what I'm asking for from one person, I have to, you know, put on my big girl panties and ask somebody else. Or, or I do it myself.
That's correct.
But I've learned to, I'm 58 years old, and I'm not going to hold back asking for what I want because I'm afraid someone's going to say no. And they do. Some people say no, and that's okay. It doesn't mean I'm a loser. It doesn't mean I'm unworthy of love. It just means for whatever reason, that person is taking care of themselves. And say, and one of the things we say in Cuddle Party is thank you for taking care of yourself. By if you need
That's
to say
really
no,
good.
Thank you for taking care of yourself.
I think there are a lot of people out here who think like I do, like you do, that have a hard time. They've been turned down once or twice or three times, and they don't have the kind of personality that just goes for what they want, and they don't try again. They just learn that it doesn't work for them. So I could understand that this would be really helpful.
Oh, yeah. And I learn something every time I go. I would say that since 2006, I've facilitated, I know, well over 300 of them. And you think about how many people, let's just say 15, 20 people come to each one, how many thousands of people have been touched by being at this workshop. And I think that just like depression is contagious or sadness or loneliness, so too is joy. So too is nurturing and affection. There's a hormone called oxytocin that our body produces when we're in love, when mothers nurse, when we have an orgasm, but also when we cuddle. It's called the cuddle hormone. And imagine being on an oxytocin high.
I manufacture it in my backyard.
You have what? Can you say it again?
I said I was manufacturing it in my backyard.
In the backyard, okay. What I say is more oxytocin means less OxyContin. Oxytocin is a great pain reliever. You know, we don't need prescription, we don't need OxyContin when we have oxytocin.
Absolutely.
So people float out of there and create community, make friends, enhance their relationships. It's just a beautiful thing. It's one of the best trainings I've ever taken, and it's a joy, absolute joy to offer. I'm based in the Philadelphia area, so most of them I do are from here down through Virginia. I have a friend in Falls Church, Virginia, near D.C., that hosts me doing Cuddle Party. I've got one coming up at the end of September.
And that's in Virginia?
In Virginia, in Falls Church, Virginia. Where are you? I mean, I know people are listening all over the place. But
yeah, everybody's all over. I'm in Pennsylvania, actually, in the Philly area. Now, you also, your own practice. You do freelance writing, workshops, presentations. You're also an interfaith minister. Is that true?
Uh-huh.
Oh, my God.
Yeah,
so when you do workshops, what kind of workshops?
Well, it can range anything from spirituality to sexuality to creativity, writing. I teach, because I'm a licensed social worker, I teach continuing education classes for other social workers. My favorite is called the Taboo Subjects: Sex, Religion, and Death. And people wouldn't think that the religion and death part are much fun, but I make it fun. And I teach loss and grief workshops.
Cuddle
Party workshops, as you mentioned. And the idea of, we talked about the whole life makeover. That when we think of makeovers, we think of body, external, clothing, hair, nails, jewelry, makeup. This is more of an internal makeover, because there isn't a person on the planet that hasn't been knocked on their butt by something in their lives.
That's right.
Whether, yeah, I mean, in my case, it was my husband died in 1998, but in 1992, we had what I lovingly call a year from hell. We had just moved down to Homestead, Florida, and brought our magazine down there with us, did a second regional edition in Florida. In February of that year, we had just adopted our son, who was almost five, and he had some baggage that he came to us with. In March of that year, I had an ectopic pregnancy, which means the baby developed in the fallopian tube and it ruptured. I didn't even know I was pregnant at the time. In May of that year, my husband was diagnosed with hepatitis C. In August of that year, we lost our home to Hurricane Andrew. We were at Ground Zero, Homestead, Florida. January of 93, we moved back up to the Philly area and spent the next few years with my husband going in and out of the hospital, continuing the magazine to the best of our ability. And at the time, I had also taken a job as a nursing home social worker because we couldn't support ourselves just with the magazine. And he died in December of 1998. So I became a single mom widow at 40 of an 11-year-old son. And I raised him as a single parent. God bless him. He is now 30, getting married on August 12th. I am over the moon excited. I love my future daughter-in-law. He's happy. He's healthy. He's a good man. And so I made it through that. So I had to recreate my life as that 40-year-old. And then now I'm 58. The next round of life getting lengthy, my dad was diagnosed with Parkinson's probably in 2007 or maybe early 2008, and he died in April of 2008. My mom was diagnosed with congestive heart failure, as I mentioned, and we went on the hospice journey together from May of 2010 until she died the day after Thanksgiving, November 26th of 2010. In my book that you mentioned, Blissmistress Guide, we talk a lot. The Dalai Lama interview is in the book, by the way. But my mom's two chapters about my journey with my mom was one of the most spiritual experiences that I had ever had. You know, we talked about life and death and a whole bunch of, you know, everything. We didn't miss a drop. So my mom died. I became an adult orphan, and because I was,
I felt that way too, by the way. I was an adult orphan.
So you know the experience. So because I was a social worker who dealt with hospice with both my parents, I was the minister who officiated at both of their services because I didn't want a rabbi that didn't know them to deliver the eulogy, so I did it. And it also kept me sane and vertical in the meantime. And I was also my mom's power of attorney. And what I say is that the grieving daughter got shuttled aside into a room with the door closed and, you know, in service of keeping on, keeping on.
Yes.
And that's been my MO all of my life.
Yes.
And so on the third anniversary of my mom's death, I developed shingles on the left side of my face. The entire left side, I look like a Klingon from Star Trek, and I had ridges and bumps, and my eye was swollen shut, and I had the stabbing pain. But I still had to go to work. I had my, as a minister, I got to officiate at my first same-sex Delaware wedding when it first became legal in Delaware. And I said, I am not missing this. So I stuck circular bandages on the lesions of my forehead and drove the hour and a half to Delaware with a chisel in my head. I officiated. I drove home and slept for like 24 hours or something. And it took a while for the, you know, for the shingles to dissipate. And I thought, okay, that's my body's way of slowing down. I better do it. Well, I didn't listen because 6 months later, I had a heart attack at 55. I was on my way home from the gym, and I thought I was in great shape, but apparently my heart didn't agree with me. So I was out of commission for a couple of weeks, took 2 weeks off of work. I was working as a therapist in an outpatient drug and alcohol rehab, taking on more people's stuff and not setting boundaries. And my friends and family insisted that I at least take 2 weeks off. I started a job working for a company like right after that. I had just been offered a job where I could work from home as a journalist. Best paying job I'd ever had. Easy to do, writing articles about addiction recovery and mental health issues. And a month after, like, I just started that job a month after the heart attack. I was at a conference, covering the conference for this company, and I had a kidney stone attack. I'd never had kidney stones. I thought the headaches were bad. I wouldn't wish kidney stone pain on anybody. And I thought, okay, God, okay, universe, what is this?
Wait a minute. So you were a month after they didn't tell you that you had to stay, you know, quiet for longer than that?
Well, yeah. Well,
you just said no.
The heart attack? No. Oh, are you talking about God telling me? No,
doctors.
Oh, doctors, no. The doctors were actually fine with me going back to work the next week, but my friends and family practically had to take me down and said, you're not going anywhere. They made me take them. My friends and family made me take the time off. And because I had this job where I could work from home, I didn't have to go anywhere. But as I said, I went to cover this conference in King of Prussia, and the pain from the kidney stones took me to the hospital. So I ended up an entire weekend in and out of the hospital with kidney stones. Then I thought, okay, now I got the message finally. And then a couple months later, I was diagnosed with adrenal fatigue. What I came to realize is that I'm a workaholic. That's literally my addiction. You know, people are addicted to substances. I'm addicted to the behavior of workaholism.
Mm-hmm.
I can't not work. It feels incredibly anxiety provoking if I'm not doing something. So I've learned to take naps. I've learned to slow down. I'm now no longer a type A, I'm a type B plus. I've kicked it back a couple notches. I've taken more vacations, and I let people do things for me. I'm learning to receive. So that, for me, is my whole life makeover.
I want to talk about that when we come back. I'm going to take a few minutes of a break, and then when we come back, I want to ask Edie a few things about being bitter or making it bitter. Mm-hmm. We'll be back in a sec. You're listening to BBS and Growing Up Indigo. Everybody, welcome back to Growing Up Indigo with Adina on BBS Radio with Edie Weinstein, who is actually the Bliss Mistress, and I love that name. By the way, I just wanted to say something and acknowledge something to her. She is at www.optimistical.com, and one of the things that she says is that she sees everything optimistically, I think. I think she says it a little bit better. She looks at how we can look at everything in a transformational way. And we were talking privately before about life experiences and do they make you better or bitter. And when I was younger, and nothing got me down, nothing that ever happened to me got to me until life, until I had, you know, those years that killed me. And then I was bitter, and then I did have post-traumatic stress disorder, which took years to get over, and then I got better. So I want to ask Edie, what makes someone be better and not bitter?
Well, I think it's a desire for change to occur. Now, keep in mind, I'm not minimizing anybody's trauma. I was a therapist for 38 years, something like that. I've worked with a lot of trauma survivors. So there are people who are legitimately victimized by other people. There are probably listeners who are abuse survivors, trauma survivors. Mm-hmm. There are people who have lost loved ones, whose relationships have ended, who felt betrayed, who had life-challenging illnesses. Life happening, life getting lifey. So we sometimes are victimized and sometimes feel victimized. So there are three concepts, and I didn't make this up, but I use them a lot, is victim, survivor, thriver. A victim is someone I define as being at the mercy of a circumstance or someone else's actions, whether intentional or unintentional. And victims who stay victimized or stay feeling like victims think, poor me, this is never going to get any better. It always, you know, why does this always happen to me? It's like Charlie Brown and Eeyore kind of combined. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not poking fun at anybody because I take very seriously that there are people with sincere mental health challenges that may not know how to get out of that. And that's where a good therapist can help someone. But the next step is survivor. And all of us have survived everything that has ever mm-hmm. happened in our life. I survived being a young widow. I survived raising a child on my own. I survived major job changes and financial challenges. I survived the deaths of my parents and my own health stuff. And what got me through was remembering something my father used to say a lot. He would, and this is kind of a mixed blessing. He would say, if that's the worst thing that ever happens to you, you'll be all right. And it could sound dismissive or it could sound supportive. And I try to make it sound supportive, like, okay, you're right, Daddy, I got through everything. So what makes me think I'm not going to get through this one? I know that I have resources and skills and faith and people in my corner. I know my spiritual faith, as I said, is part of what gets me through. So that's the survivor part. Then there's the thriver. A thriver is somebody who thrives, who can make it through anything, and then takes what they've learned to help other people. You look at people like Bill W., who created AA, or Alex's Lemonade, parents who experience the unthinkable, the death of their child, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, the mm-hmm. person that created that. They decided consciously that they were going to take their pain and transmute it into something valuable for other people. That, to me, is a thriver. Viktor Frankl, who wrote Man's Search for Meaning, is probably one of the best examples of being a thriver, because he said that the Nazis could imprison his body, but they couldn't make him hate. They couldn't touch his thoughts. Those were his. And I encourage anybody who feels like a victim to say, I ask some of my clients, you want to get back at the perpetrator who hurt you? And they say, yeah, sometimes. I say, have a good life. Don't do to anybody else what was done to you. Mm-hmm. Break the cycle of abuse. And don't do to yourself what was done to you. Don't hurt yourself. And I know that may be easier said than done, but I encourage people who may be feeling that way, you deserve better than to continue to perpetuate the cycle of abuse. And you deserve a good life. So that's the victim, survivor, thriver. When people do that, they feel better rather than bitter. And then I think, why would I want to hold resentment? It doesn't change what happened. No amount of resentment, no amount of anger is going to change what happened.
That's true, but we have to get there on our own, and it takes a while sometimes. Yep. I think also the everyday person who just makes it a point, who just survives and helps another person, is also a hero. One of the things I used during my period of, you know, cancer and all that I had gone through in 1 year was take it moment to moment, and I would just say to myself, at this moment, you're okay. And that's how I would do it. At this moment, I was okay. And sometimes that's the way you have to do it. So I want to just talk about some of the other things that you've done, because you are just, if I want to talk about your radio show, do you still have that going?
No, I don't. I did it for 3 years. It was a blog talk show called It's All About Relationships, and it was an interview show just like yours. And I did it in, I'm trying to think how to describe it. It was another one of those transcendent experiences. And as you know, it's a labor of love. It's a way of introducing people, again, to their author, favorite authors, speakers, and so on. So I stopped doing it when my producer decided that he wanted to take a different path as well. And we're still in touch with each other, but it was a routine every Thursday night for 3 years. I was doing the show. So I missed it. I miss it occasionally, but it's still, people can still listen to it if they want to check it out. It's All About Relationships. VividLife.me is the website, and they're all archived, all 3 years of them. So if people want to listen to the interviews, they're welcome to do that. The other cool thing that I do that's helpful for me, connected a little bit connected with Cuddle Party, a little bit connected with the heart attack and recreating my life, was are you familiar with the idea of free hugs?
Yes.
Have you ever seen people standing on the street corners, with the free hug signs?
No,
I
have
do that.
To tell you, my son
never done it.
Turn around and say to us, "Free hugs! I'm giving free hugs for everyone." It was just adorable.
Yeah.
But no, I do know about free hugs, but I don't know about them.
The concept. Okay. Well, since you're in Philadelphia, I definitely can. I do them in Philly a lot. My very first free hugs flash mob, I organized Valentine's Day weekend of 2014 at 30th Street Station. And for those that don't know, that's the big train station in Philly. So there were a dozen of us. And I wanted to do it with the idea that, number one, Valentine's Day is not just for lovers, for, you know,
totally,
for romantic relationships.
Totally agree.
And that it's not just one day of the year. Every day can be Valentine's Day. So a whole bunch of us went there. And at the appointed hour at 12 o'clock, we wandered around the train station and asked people if they wanted hugs. And a lot of people said yes. A few said no. But the most poignant experience was this Iraqi war vet that approached us. And he was the only one that survived in his platoon. And he had survivor's guilt. And he had had suicidal thoughts. And he said, you know, I thought about killing myself until I met you people. Can I join you? So he walked around with a free hug sign, hugging people. And then friends started calling us hug mobsters, you know, hug mob, flash mob. And I thought, oh, mobsters. Violence, guns, drugs. And I said, but what about armed with love? So that's the tagline. We're hug mobsters armed with love. June of that year is when I had the heart attack, June 12th of 2014. And as part of my cardiac rehab, I walked. And I live near Doylestown in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. So I would do my free hug strolls through Doylestown. And I walked around hugging people. Then
how did they react when you did that?
Well, some people, most people, again, just like at 30th Street Station, they loved it. A few people said no, and and they have every right to say no, because remember, we're talking about touch consent. And whenever they'd say no, they'd usually say, nah, I'm good. And I'd say, I know you're good, but go hug somebody. Hug yourself. You don't have to hug me or us, you know, the people. Because sometimes I just do it by myself. I keep the signs in my car, and if I'm so moved to do it, I whip out the signs, and I just walk around wherever I am. And people recognize, oh, you're the hug lady. You know, I saw you on TV. It was Good Day Philadelphia came out to Doylestown a couple years ago, and they filmed that, among other things. They filmed us, too. We were kind of like local color. And so since then, I've done them at various parades, at the Memorial Day Parade in Doylestown, 4th of July Parade in Philly, at the DNC when that was in Philly. I did it at 30th Street Station again. I did it in D.C. I've done it a lot since the election, as you can well imagine.
Yes.
And when I hug people, I don't know who they voted for. And my whole idea is to make America kind again, make it a more loving place, a more inclusive and accepting place. And, you know, we're so divided by culture, by religion, by gender, by sexual preference, by, you know, none of that stuff matters. We're human beings, and we need that kind of nurturing touch. Mm-hmm. There's a video that a friend created for me for my third cardioversary, which was this past June, where she followed me around South Street. You know South Street, I would mm-hmm. imagine, in Philly, and she taped it. So you can look up Hug Mobsters Philadelphia or Freedom Films, and it was so much fun. Watching people's reactions. Some said no. She taped some people saying no. This beautiful Muslim woman had approached, when I approached her, probably, of course, who doesn't love hugs? Everybody needs hugs. That's how she said it. And I said, some people don't want it. She says, even those that don't want it, they need it.
Well, they
and
need
I
it from
wish.
Somebody else. They don't want it from yeah. her, maybe. And I
well, no.
That.
She wasn't talking about her. She was talking about in general. And I thought, if only the people that feared anybody that they perceived as being different could see this beautiful woman. And I thought their fear would just disappear. I mean, she was one of the highlights of this day for me. You have to watch it. I'll send you the link to it if you haven't already seen it. But that's one of my greatest joys. And that's part of my whole life makeover, is doing this. This is my... it's part of my bliss. You mentioned the bliss
right.
mistress concept.
Mm-hmm.
Where that came from was Joseph Campbell. Are you familiar with his
yes.
work?
Yes.
Yeah. He talked about the idea of following your bliss.
Mm-hmm.
So back in 2007, maybe, I created a workshop called BYOB, Be Your Own Bliss. And I was on my way in to teach it, and this person walking into the workshop said, oh, you're the bliss master. You're going to teach us how to live blissfully. So when I came home, I called this friend, and I mentioned it to him. He said, oh, no, not bliss master, bliss mistress, and mm-hmm. kind of like a double entendre. And mm-hmm. he says, but if you're going to call yourself that, you better be living it. So
right.
that's part of my bliss. And that's why I called my book, The Bliss Mistress Guide.
Well, when I first saw the title, I was sitting there thinking, the bliss mistress, huh? You know, I was just wondering. And I obviously knew it wasn't that, but I thought that for a second.
Yeah.
The book, where can we get the book? Is it on Amazon?
You can order from Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Amazon, you have The Bliss Mistress Guide to Transforming the Ordinary into the Extraordinary. And I think we can do that. I think anything can be, anything that feels ordinary can be made extraordinary. You talked about the optimistical concept. A couple of years ago, it either came to me in a meditation or a dream or something, and it said, you're not just an optimist, you're an OPTI-mystic who sees
wow.
the world through the eyes of possibility. So my website is OPTI-mystical.com, and I like to look at the world through the eyes of possibility, because anything could happen, anything could change in a heartbeat, for better or for worse, and I don't want to miss a thing.
That's true.
I don't want to miss any opportunity.
That's true. My mother used to tell me when I was very, very depressed, I had committed suicide when I was a young 20-something, very young. Mm-hmm. And I took a year thinking about it, and she would just stand there and cry and say, your life can turn on a dime. And I refused yep. to see any possibility. And of course I lived, and of course I changed. And I
yeah.
began to do what I do. And it's so true. Your life can literally open up in this moment, right now.
Yeah.
Your life can change completely. Just open up.
Yeah.
Just open up and realize that anything is possible,
mm-hmm.
and it can be
yeah.
wonderful. So that's true.
Well,
it depends on how you see things.
Absolutely. And the other piece of that is... we have a choice as to how we look at anything. I look at the idea of a miracle. Like, of course, a miracle says that a miracle is a shift in perception. When
mm-hmm.
you see something differently, everything changes.
When you feel it. You
after
have
the
to
heart
feel
attack.
It.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah, after the heart attack, I was having breakfast with two friends, my friends Patricia and Yvonne, and both of them are mentors of the sorts for me. Yvonne's been my mentor for 30 years,
mm-hmm.
and she's a survivor, a thriver. And her name is Yvonne Kay. and she survived World War II. And she lived in England during the Blitzkrieg and was on the Kinder transport. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that.
Yes,
but
I do. Yes.
It was a train that took children from London to the countryside so that they could be safe. So she had that experience, and she's had PTSD since then. Mm-hmm. She's now 83 or 84, and she's like my mama now. She's, you know. And the other, Patricia Gallagher, is the Angel Pin Lady and the Flower Lady. They would both be really cool to have on your show. Mm-hmm. They're incredibly inspiring women, and they're both very active volunteers and just big hearts. So I was on my way into having breakfast with them and a couple of years ago, and I just had some medical tests where they call them incidental findings, like, oh, no, I don't want to know what they are.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, my God, now what? And when I walked in, I said, no, now what? So, like, okay, God, what do you want me to do with this? Mm-hmm. How can I bless this mess in my life right now?
Yeah.
And so it's thinking about what are the possibilities rather than the perils of anything.
Right.
Other thing I learned when Michael died, when my husband died, was I get guidance like all of us do. And I, as a psychiatric social worker, I know the difference between psychotic voices and the voice of God, if you want to call it that. And when I was doing what I call God wrestling, I would say to God, he's mine and you can't have him. And God would say, no, he's mine and he's on loan to you like everybody else in your life. So that was a huge lesson that I want to appreciate everybody in my life because they're all on loan. And everybody
we are
now
ourselves,
knows
actually.
That's
true.
And everybody you now know and love will one day die or leave you, or you will die or leave them. And that's not morbid or maudlin. It's the truth.
It's the truth. But
so,
we are never we are never apart from them. Really, we're apart.
Oh, yeah.
They're there. They're here. I'm a medium, so I'm always connected to everyone. And we are. We just don't realize it.
Yep. Yeah, I see, you know, I talk to my parents all the time, and I hear their voices in my head. I hear guidance from them. I miss them. Sometimes my sister and what we call I miss mommy days. But I think, what would my parents say? How would they guide me? So I know that they're there. I definitely, and my mom shows up in the form of a butterfly.
Everybody comes in a certain way to people. I have to wind down the show. But it's been a pleasure having you on. I'd love to have you on again.
My pleasure.
And I want to tell everybody that I will be back for Meta Mondays on Monday, August 6th, and somewhere in the late morning. So I'm very excited to be back with Meta Mondays. I love Mondays. And Edie, where can everybody reach you? It's at www.opsi-mystical.com. Correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay.
And I'm also very active on Facebook. They can find me there under Edie Weinstein, W-E-I-N-S-T-E-I-N. And that's where I post a lot of my articles. That's where I engage with the world. I say that I don't put anything on Facebook that I don't want the whole world to know, because they will. Social media.
You can see her, she's fantastic, and she does post
Thank
a lot.
You.
And if you want more information, please contact her or contact me on my site, and I'll give you Edie's information. Thank you so much for listening and for being here, Edie. And I'll see you again on August 6th, Meta Monday. Love you guys. Bye-bye.